You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This is episode number 23 of Living the Dream with Rory O'Malley. If you like the podcast, please remember to subscribe, rate, and review.
Audition, side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
Hey there, dreamers. Rory O'Malley here. Thanks for listening to Living the Dream. How's everyone doing? This week, my guest is Michael Luaye, who is our Hamilton on the Hamilton tour, the Angelica tour that is currently in San Francisco. Michael was in the Broadway company. He was the alternate for Javi, and he joined the company about a year ago, and was the first new person to come into the show after I joined. So I really was glad to see a new face come into the building and not be the new guy anymore. Michael is so ridiculously talented and has made such a huge impact on the Hamilton company family, because he kind of stepped right into the role of Hamilton and then also on Broadway was able to step into the role of Burr and do that part as well, which is no easy feat, clearly. But what's really insane is one day Michael performed, I think it was on the matinee, he performed Burr, and at night he was Hamilton. He performed both roles in the same day. I don't think that's been done since. It certainly wasn't done before that. So the man has many, many, many talents. He's a really humble, sweet, quiet guy, as you'll hear on the podcast, but I learned so much about him that I didn't realize about how he got into theater and his journey to get to the role of Hamilton at just the age of 26. He's 26 years old. This guy is going to be doing a lot of great things in this business, and he's one of those people that I'm just glad I'm going to get to say I knew him when, and that I got to be in Hamilton on Broadway and in the Hamilton tour. The Hamilton tour, it's a real privilege to get to work with this guy. And we talk about our favorite. I've decided it's his favorite moment of the show, but it's definitely mine, is connecting with him at the end of the show. And I was glad I got to talk with him about that. He and I see each other at the end of every show, and to look somebody in the eyes who has just performed the role of Hamilton in Hamilton, an American musical, at the end of every show is pretty daunting. And to see what his journey has been for those 3 hours compared to my journey, which is a very different experience. I'm in a musical comedy and he's, you know, telling the story of America. But he's such a great guy, and I'm so glad that I got to share his story. So please enjoy my conversation with Michael Luaye, Hamilton. Hi, Michael.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. We are in your dressing room after a matinee performance. Wonderful matinee performance.
Edgerham performance.
An Edgerham performance. What is an Edgerham?
Edgerham is when we perform the show for the kids.
For the kids.
Students in the area. It's so amazing. And this crowd was freaking electrifying today.
Yeah. And which it's, you never know what you're going to get with these kids.
Yeah. Usually the crowds, like, you know that they're going to be like very active.
Right.
Before and after the show, but once the show starts,
all the in between,
it's like they're a listening crowd. Sometimes they completely listen. Sometimes where like adult audiences will react, they react like tenfold in one direction, or like very, very quiet.
Yeah,
it's unpredictable what an Edgerham audience will be like.
Yeah, and the things that they laugh at,
yes,
at all, like they will laugh in the places that you've never had a response, and the places for me where I'm like, yeah, that's my money, uh-huh, joke, it's crickets.
Doesn't
every
happen.
Time
oh my
every
goodness.
Time I always laugh to myself when I say they say George Washington's yielding his power and stepping away. Mm-hmm. Is that true? I wasn't aware that was something a person could do. Laughs every night.
Uh-huh.
It has never gotten a laugh
from Etchingham.
Never.
Even
once.
In New York?
Never.
Oh,
never.
My gosh.
No. And I just think it's funny because the joke is, you know, this privileged character, this man who just assumes that he's, you know, he's born into ruling a country.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I just wonder if it's like such a foreign concept. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I completely do, because I wonder that. I mean, if I was in high school, I don't think that I would catch that myself, you know, at that time. I probably wouldn't be thinking that, so I'd probably be a part of that silence.
Well, me too. But it's funny because it reminds me that it's such a well-written show because you can perform it for 2,300 high school students and they have a completely different experience and a different entry point into it that is different from the people who come to see it who are like, you know, paying top dollar for a ticket.
Like people in the audience who are teachers themselves, who are history teachers.
Right.
People who obsess over history and they know like all of this actual factual
people
information.
Who love hip-hop who are just like catching all the different references that Lynn put in there to hip-hop music. People love musicals. But Etchingham is a education for us as well.
Boom.
okay, let's get into, we're very lucky to have each other on this Hamel tour here in San Francisco. I certainly feel very lucky that you were a part of this because we were both in the New York cast. And I'll never forget the day you ran to my dressing room when it was announced,
that day was I was sitting in my dressing room and our PSM on Broadway, Amber White, came to me, and I knew that I was leaving the show on Broadway by that point. And she had known that I was leaving too, but like very, very few people knew.
Sure.
I wasn't really allowed to tell anybody.
Yeah.
And so she came up to me and she said that we were going to have an email for goings and comings, like people who were leaving the show, people who were coming into the show, and you won't be included into this, talking to me.
Right.
In this one, because we're not ready to announce it yet. We'll be announcing it at a later date. But it will include Rory. And I was like, and I knew that you were leaving the show at a point.
Right.
But she said, because Rory's going to be going to the West Coast tour. And I was like, wait, what? And so, like, after we had that discussion and everything like that, she left. And I booked it to your dressing room. And I was like, wait, you're going to the going to be on the West Coast tour. I'm going to be your Hamilton. I loved that.
I'll never forget it because it wasn't just that I was excited that I was going to have a buddy on this on this journey, but that you were going to be given the reins in this role and have your own company. And I just, you so earned it. You were so ready, and I was so thrilled for you. And that was hard for me. It was harder for me to keep it a secret that you were going to be Hamilton than it was for me to say that I was going to be the king on the tour.
Yeah, oh, man.
That I was leaving. Because it was just so exciting.
Yeah.
Now let's go into how you got into the show, because you came into the show at a point that, I mean, not that I was with it too much before, but I can't imagine a crazier time for any Broadway show than the period between when the Tonys happened last year to when Lynn, Leslie, and Pippa, Philippa Sue left the show July 9th of last year. That period of time, which would have been like mid-June to July 9th, The Richard Rodgers was crazy.
Chaos.
It was chaos.
Yeah, it really, really was.
And you, that was your week one.
Yeah, I joined the show the day after the Tonys.
Wow.
Yeah. So I remember, like, we were sitting down watching the Tonys, and I was with my friends from school, and like they were like kind of just like looking at me because they knew that I was just about to join the show, and we watched like the Hamilton performance on the Tonys and all of the festivities and everything, and I knew that I was going to be stepping into the show like that next day, and I believe that's right. The Tonys on the 12th of that year day,
maybe.
If the Tonys were the 12th, then I joined on that Tuesday, which was the 14th. So that's when I started rehearsals, was the 14th. So I joined right after the Tonys.
Yeah.
And not knowing any sort of, like, not having any reference to how the show was on the outside, because I hadn't really been around the theater or anything like that. I came and I got my script and then I left and then started rehearsals. But it was really overwhelming. I'd gone in... just to see like the Ham for Ham crowds at that time, like that was at the time when it was still outside and people were lined up for blocks, just trying to get a ticket. It was around the time when Lynn and everybody was leaving, so, and it was still with a lot of the original. It was with all of the original.
Yeah, I think
members.
I was the only new person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was strangely intimidating. Strangely just because I'd never joined a show that was already created, that was already running before. Mm-hmm. Up to that point, I'd been doing a lot of newer works or staying with one show as it's developing. So I hadn't really joined a show where a role was established and the show was still really in its like infancy.
Right.
This is only like coming up on 2.5, perhaps. Is that it?
Well, yeah. Yeah. 2.5, if including the public. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's still very, very young.
Yeah.
And so going into that and just trying to keep a level head, it was a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't. So, what was your experience of getting the job, the audition experience?
Okay. So I had been auditioning for the show since the public, off and on. Mm-hmm. I'd auditioned for the show, and I was going in for Mulligan Madison originally. And I auditioned for the public production. I didn't... I got a call back, but I didn't hear anything back from that. Mm-hmm. So I parted ways from it. And then we started auditioning again in January of last year. And I started getting information about it and like beginning that time to start prepping for auditions. And then I did my audition 2 days after, or the day after the Grammy performance, so like another like big hoopla of a moment.
Yeah.
And I bombed. It was so bad. It was so bad. It was bad because when you get the audition information, there's like a title sheet that they gave us.
Yeah.
And it said the names of the songs that you're going in for that character, what you were doing. And so, or just for like the general audition or whatnot. And I'd read the titles the second round, and I'd looked at it and I was like, oh, they're the same titles as the first round back when I was auditioning for the public. So I know that material. I don't really need to look at it too much. So I'd like rehearse that material internally by myself. And then the day of the Grammys happened and I was like, let me just refresh like what that information was. So I opened the email and I looked at the material for the new packet and the songs were the same. The name of the songs were the same, but the information had completely changed. There was an old, like the verses for Washington on Your Side were completely different.
Wow.
The melody for Theodosia changed. The only thing that was like consistent was the Mulligan Madison rap. And even when I was auditioning back at the public, I didn't have that. In the sense of like breath support and everything, I couldn't get through it. So I went into it. I crammed like crazy that night, and I went into that audition, and it was so bad. The accompanist Ming at that time, he was Ming. he was he like tried to slow down for me for the stuff for Washington on Your Side, and I still couldn't get it. It was just, and I just gave up, left defeated, and I was like, well, that's never going to happen. So I left. I went back home that day, and I got an email from my agent that asked if I wanted to do this reading at La Jolla. Mm-hmm. So I said yes, because I was like, I need to do something to wash away what just happened.
Send me to La Jolla.
Please, yes. So I did the reading at La Jolla, and then I came, while I was there, they'd asked me back, they called me back for Hamilton, and I was like, you must be crazy, but I'm not gonna question
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Isn't that
funny though, how we do that, how we think we bomb something, it's the worst, mm-hmm. and that's when they call.
Exactly. but I wasn't able to get there because I was still in California, right. So I was like, can we reschedule? And we tried, and the rescheduling didn't happen. So I'd left that alone. I did another show in between, and then I got I got information to come back again for Mulligan Madison, and I started auditioning again in May, and I auditioned. I came in. I did the general for Mulligan Madison, and then I got a call back, and they started adding tracks. So this was for Mulligan Madison and Lafayette Jefferson. So I learned all the material that was required for that.
You learned the entire show,
pretty
Michael.
Much. Pretty much. So I did that, and then that audition was great. And I thought that I was going towards the Chicago company.
Right.
And I'd gotten information that they wanted me to come in for Hamilton for the Chicago company for the alternate standby for that. And I didn't really, I had a hard time with it because I was like, I don't know if I can actually leave New York at that time.
Yeah.
So I turned that down. And then they had asked me if I was interested in coming in just for like future New York auditions or something like that, or just right. for future New York opportunities
yeah.
for it. And I was like, okay, I'll come in. So I'd learned the Hamilton material, and then like a week before, they said, can you also learn Burr? And I was like, no.
Are you kidding
yeah.
me?
Yeah, and so I came
oh
in.
Oh, my God.
And I went in, and my very, very last audition for the show was for Hamilton and Burr. And then I left, and I went to work, and I found out at work that I'd gotten Hamilton, that I was going to be the new Hamilton alternate.
And what was work?
I was catering for a catering company, Thomas Preddy Catering. Mm-hmm. I was catering for that, and I
where you were at work? I want to know exactly where.
I was in the basement, putting on my tuxedo, getting ready to, because we just set up the event at Gotham Hall in New York, and I was putting on my tuxedo, was just getting ready, and I saw that I had a missed phone call from my agent, so I was like, it must be some sort of information. Usually, after an audition, my agent calls me and asks like just how it went. And that's how the conversation started. Once I called him back, he was just like, so how'd it go? How was it? And I was like, and I thought it was really good. Of course, there are things that I felt like I could do better, but I really, really felt good about it. And, you know, that I'm ready for like next year once we, like if they call me back for it, so that we can prep for it again. And he was like, well, I hope that you're ready to perform the role of Hamilton on Broadway. And he had everything like on speakerphone, so everybody in the office was there, and they were like, congratulations and all this stuff. And I was just like, what?
Wow.
Because I mean, like, truly,
and was that your Broadway debut?
That's my Broadway debut. I never thought that I was going to be on Broadway, because I like the way that I got into theater, it just didn't seem like a thing to me.
Okay, well, tell me that. Well, what does that mean? You never thought you were going to be on Broadway.
Yeah, because, I mean, I was theater. I've been doing theater since, like, middle school, but it was always something like a side thing.
And where did you grow up?
In Huntsville, Alabama.
Okay.
So I'd been doing theater and singing and everything, like, since elementary school, but that was never something that I, like, it was never a dream of mine to do theater, you know. I think that it sort of fits in. Like I remember talking with my brother, and he was like, when you were younger, you used to like pretend that you were like Pat Sajak and like all of these things. And like,
wait, what?
I guess Wheel of Fortune was my one of my favorite shows when I was younger. And so like he said that I like would like pretend to be like a game show host when I was younger.
Okay.
And I guess that I don't remember that at all, but I guess I did that at some point.
I pretended to be Vanna White. So
oh, nice.
We would have gotten along.
Yeah, that's why we're here. But he'd... I wanted to be an artist when I was younger. I wanted to draw when I was younger, and then that evolved to me wanting to be a musician. And I'd gone into college thinking that I was going to go in for music theory and composition because I wanted to be a composer at a point.
And where were you? Where did you go to college?
The University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa.
That's right.
Roll Tide. Yes. I never really thought that I was going to do it. So when I was going in for auditions for school, I had auditioned for only two schools. I went in for two schools. I started to apply to other schools, but then I just decided that I was going to just stay in Alabama. I didn't want to go to anywhere that was super close to home, but nothing that was super far away.
Yeah.
So I had auditioned for the University of Alabama in Birmingham, Alabama, and the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, which are both like a couple hours away from Huntsville. And so I got into the music program for both of those.
Right.
But I also got into the theater program for the University of Alabama. And initially they'd given me more of a scholarship, so I was like, I'll go in for that. And even in college, it was something that I just did. I'd gotten into shows and I was doing things and meeting new people, but it wasn't anything that I thought I'd do as a career. I was still saving money to the dream that I had was I was going to move to Europe and be like a session guitarist or a producer or a composer or something like that.
Wow.
I'd wanted to compose for Nintendo for a long time. So
for Nintendo?
For Nintendo, yeah. So not like, I don't know where, like the connection makes no sense. Like not, going to Europe and composing for Nintendo, I didn't know how, but that's how my mind worked. So
they really put out some good hits.
Yeah.
Da-na-na-na-na. Da-na-na-na-na.
Da-na-na-na-na. You know. No more top 10, you know? Yeah. But
That's amazing. I'm like, that could, I mean, not that it's as you love music, but you were in college and this was not the path still.
No.
So you're studying music, you graduate from college, and then...
Well, what happened was I did an apprenticeship in North Carolina at this theater called Flat Rock Playhouse.
Okay.
And the reason why I didn't really think about theater being something that I wanted to do was that I didn't feel like I belonged there. I felt like I always felt like I was new to it. I didn't feel like I fit the personality type.
Right.
That I was seeing.
What personality type?
I feel like the personality is like very, very competitive and very, very extroverted.
Yeah.
And I'm a competitive person. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
There's something about the assumption of being an actor
right.
that didn't fit with me.
Sure. You're not a in-your-face, loud,
yeah.
crazy person.
Like that type of person.
Maybe like me, you know?
No, I mean, it's one of those things, like, in a comfortable crowd or a crowd of people that I trust, like,
yeah.
absolutely, like, go all out, inhibition's gone, like,
yes.
anything like that. But for a career path, I just did not fit into it.
Right.
And I always, I very, very often felt like an outsider in school in that sense.
Hmm.
Yeah, it just didn't feel like that. But once I went to Flat Rock, that's where it sort of clicked because I felt like I belonged into all of the aspects of theater. What I love about this craft is that it's something that so many different departments and so many different people come together to do.
Right.
And so when we were there, like any like apprenticeships, you're doing every job.
Yeah.
That is in theater, and I loved that.
Yeah.
You know, on top of that, like at Flat Rock, like you also park cars, and you're doing like the children's shows and all of these things that are happening. Like you're taking classes and you're learning so much. It felt right to me, and so I left Flat Rock, And I was really excited, and I thought that I would be able to, I thought that I could do it after that. I did the apprenticeship two separate summers back to back, and after the first year, I was like, I can make this my career. But then I also didn't want to move to New York at that time. So I was like, I didn't want to move to New York because I felt like it was a dream killer, in a sense. I felt like so many people that I knew of would go to New York and then, like, just stop wanting to act.
Right.
And that made me feel like, what's the point of doing this if that's what New York does to you? Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to move to New York. I had no mindset of moving to California in any sense. So I was like, I would look at other places, and I started looking at, like, Chicago and, like, Seattle for theater and things like that. And then my professors were like, no, you're moving to New York. You have to. Wow. And so we did our showcase. And after the showcase, I met my agent, my agency. And it's been like that since. I moved and bam.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's been like that. But obviously, you're learning how to survive in New York.
Just the not whole easy. And your other education.
Yeah, yeah. Which yeah. a lot of, you know, like, and this is living the dream. So a lot of, you know, what I love to talk about is that part. Yeah. Is that, you know, it's not just about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I say bam. But
you're no, but.
Yeah.
Well, bam.
Bam, yes. Bam, yes. But.
I mean, I don't, you know, my favorite fun fact about you. Is your age, because it's not, and I don't have to say it. You can say it if you want.
You can say it if you want. But
the man is 26 years old. Okay, I got 10 years almost exactly on this guy. But what I love about that, Michael, is that you have more maturity to you than most people my age, and I think that the weight of a role like this. Could really not just, you know, people can do it, but not do it with the amount of grace and humility and dedication that you're doing at 26.
Thank
I think
you.
It's incredibly impressive. But I think that this is making a lot more sense to me now, that you didn't go into this thinking your ambition wasn't this the entire time. Mm-hmm. This is just kind of unfolded because you've been open to whatever the universe brings you as an artist. Mm-hmm. You're an artist first, and that really makes a lot more sense to me.
Word.
Now
yeah.
that you say that. But what I mean in terms of, you get to New York, you have to learn how to feed yourself and survive without doing your art. How
yeah.
hard was that?
It was very hard. Like, I feel like, Without sounding like damaged or anything like that, there's still things that I'm learning from that now.
Yeah.
You know, from that crash course of it. When I moved to New York, I had a sublet for... So I moved to New York on the 1st of September, 2013. And my sublet that I had gotten from a friend ended the 17th of October. Mm-hmm. Same year, and so I had like that much time, and I didn't know what was after that. But I'd gone to New York with this one audition. My agent had sent me an audition for this show called Witness Uganda. Mm-hmm. And on the train, I took a train from Alabama to New York, and on the train I was like reading the audition and everything like that, and I'd auditioned for the show once I got there, on and on and on. And I got the show on the day before I left. I booked the show.
Right.
In between all of that time was figuring out what it is to live on your own without knowing what's going to come next. Because with that show, if something had happened like, oh, we need you to stay until the 18th.
Right.
What does that mean? I don't have a place to live.
Right.
So where am I going to stay?
Right.
I don't know any of those things. And so that, like, it felt very, 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 very small. Like,
right.
everything needed to happen, like, now,
and it's
now,
always,
now, now.
And it's always like, we'll just figure it out.
Yeah.
This is the opportunity that is being presented to you. Mm-hmm. It's up to you to figure out all the other stuff.
Yeah. I was looking at jobs. I was trying to get, like, things as an... I tried to become, like, an usher at mm-hmm. a point to try to get something. But I had no job experience. I had no work experience. I had always... in between summers and stuff like that, I did like summer stock or I did an apprenticeship or something.
Right.
And I wasn't working through college. So it was like the money that I made in college was for playing guitar for people. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really have that sort of job. And I wasn't to the level of skill to play for a show at that time. So I was like, there's nothing that I can really do. So I have to be working in shows. So the money that I went to New York with, I had to figure out how to like cut that so that I can buy food and survive in that sense. It was really, really difficult. Plus the rent money and everything that I had. So it's like figuring out where that goes. But I got that show. And then I did Witness Uganda at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Where I saw you.
Yes.
Because that was written by my friends, Griffin mm-hmm. and Matt.
Yes.
And I went to Carnegie Mellon with Griffin.
Yeah.
And Leslie Odom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were all in the same class. All yeah, and all. You were phenomenal. Thank you. It was a gorgeous, gorgeous production. The cast was amazing, and your part in particular was just like, that was remarkable. So it must have been quite the experience to put that up.
It was a hell of a learning experience because, like, I didn't have money to, like, take classes. There's so many people that would tell me, like, once you get to New York, like, you have to take classes. You have to, like, keep building your skill and everything like that and take dance classes and take acting classes and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And my education after school was really from learning from my fellow actors and what they did. They had the range of experience was from people who are new to New York, like me, who just graduated, to people who have been in the business and been on Broadway and been doing things for so long. And it's just like, these are the people that I'm learning from.
Right.
This is where I learn.
Right.
Being tossed in the fire, doing a lead role for this new show. It's like, that's where I'm getting my education from, right. From there, you know? So it's
that tribe that you create in college, those people that you, work with mm-hmm. On an equal footing in college. When you get out into the real world, they become so much more important. Mm-hmm. And those relationships are it's really important to keep those relationships.
Yeah.
And to take care of each other, because someone's going to have success, someone's going to have failure at different mm-hmm. moments. It's not all going to happen at the same time for everyone, and you need to catch each other and support each other, and it's yeah. just priceless.
Yes. But yeah, like after that show had finished, I moved back to New York, and I once again had no job, and it was like a dry season for auditions and things like that. And I'd stayed temporarily with the stage manager from Witness Uganda, and I also had lined up for after that sublet to spend time with one of the ASMs mm-hmm. There, one of the assistant stage managers from the show. And in between that time, I was looking for work, trying to get a job, but also it was my first time being in New York. So I didn't know the game yeah. of like living in New York really well. And it was hard. Like it was like immediate high and then immediate low. I'd started looking for like my own work and everything like that outside of my agency, and I found this commercial thing, and I got the commercial, and I did the like small commercial thing. I don't know what happened to that. Never saw any footage from it.
I've done a few of those things yeah. where you're like, where did that ever go?
What was that thing? Yeah. I feel like it was like there's a picture or some media of me in like Australia or some
random place. Yeah, some other company.
Yeah. But I did that. And then like the next week, I tried to get this job as a bartender, and I got scammed out of like $200 something dollars.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
How?
It was a whole setup of like... Like I went in and I thought that I was going in for like I paid for like this like a background check and for classes to take to get my like bartending certificate or something like that. And me being me,
yeah.
like I was like, okay, so I'm gonna go and before the class starts, like I'm gonna learn how to make all these drinks and everything like that, so that I'm ready for the class. I know some information, and so yeah. I started looking up that, and I started looking at some information about like bartending certificate or whatever that thing was. And there was this article that was like, bartending certificate, yes or no, or like real or fake. ? And I was like, what? And I started reading that, and I read the article, and it was like, there's no such thing as this. I was like, wait. And so I started looking up more information about the place, and it was like stock photos on a website. And I was like, this is insane. And then I was like, I don't know what, wait. And so I was like looking, and there was no way for me to get my money back. And even if, like, I tried to call, like, the Better Business Bureau and try to figure out if I can get money off of that, like, for not money back, but, like, if I could get these people shut down, but at the same time, I'd have to pay more money so that they could go find them. Yeah. And this was, like, my savings. I was living off my savings at that point from that I made from Witness Uganda.
Yeah, of course.
And so I was like, I don't know. I can't risk that. And so I was out $200-something that was going towards other things. And I didn't have a lot at that point, plus, like, rent money saved. So I needed to, like, strategize all that. And I was just like, okay. So I was so mad at that moment.
Oh, my God.
It was just like, this is, like, the taste of New York that I was feeling. Yeah. And so after that, I moved in and I went to I did the second sublet. And I finally found a job. And I found the catering job with Thomas Pretty.
Great gig.
Yeah. But at that time, it was also frustrating because I was trying to get the job honest. I was trying to get jobs honestly. And I was...
It's not easy.
It's not easy. When you have no experience and, like, you're trying to fill a resume with all the things that you have done, a work resume for a muggle job, it's, like, it's so hard to do.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I found a reference, and I, like... faked it till I made it until I got into Thomas Pretty to get into that. And I was like, they gave me the job. I filled out the paperwork and everything like that. And they gave me the job, and I went in, and I was like, I was just so appreciative and so grateful for every single time that I went to cater. Cause it's one of those things that I feel like you can, I feel like there are experiences where it's like, you can be very jaded about it.
Right.
And you can, like, be very mad about it. But I was just like, without this job, without these people, I would not be living in New York. I could not be surviving here. I could not survive.
Absolutely.
And there was also a crushing time because it was like, I was doing Witness Uganda, like Witness Uganda was developing into its production that we did off Broadway, but I like lost my sublet. And so I almost was like homeless for a little bit.
Wow.
So I like needed to figure that out. And I had some friends from college who took me in and I stayed with them. But it was like all of that stuff was happening so fast. And there was like successes, but like really like murky things that were happening at the time. Mm-hmm. That was, I didn't know how to process that. And it's taking me some time to like unwind that. That's still like, it affects you in a sense that it makes you, It adds to your gratitude. It adds to your wisdom and your knowledge for what to do.
Yes.
How to survive.
Yes.
How to work. Yes. How to treat other people. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
That's you know, I always say that those years where I was out there not knowing how I was going to make ends meet, didn't even really care about auditions. I was trying to get jobs that would pay the bills, like that, like those side jobs, I am so grateful for them now, not just because they are the reason that I was able to stay in New York, stay in Los Angeles, keep doing what I loved, but because they make me a better artist and a better actor today.
Yes.
When I walk out on that stage, I have a gratitude that I know I created waiting on tables, working at a call center where, you know, doing crazy jobs. Like I've catered so many times, you know, like, I mean, those side jobs are what gave me so much of my gratitude, because gratitude's a wonderful, wonderful, resource when we're doing what we do. And, you know, I would say that it's hard to tell somebody while you're doing that job that, you know, don't worry, one day you're going to be grateful for this.
Yeah.
It's hard, but it's true.
I think it's one of those things that when it comes to gratitude, that gratitude is excellent when it's expressed for just for being.
Right.
I heard this a couple days ago, of just like I heard this like reiterated a couple days ago, where it's just like not being grateful solely for the things that you have or the way that you feel, but just because of the way things are. You might not be ready for this experience or ready to say that you're grateful for this thing, but this thing has happened and you don't know how far the ripples will be, like
right.
how it'll extend.
Right.
You don't know what's coming from this experience.
Right.
So yes, it might be very difficult at the time, but it's like to be grateful for the fact that it's even happening to you.
Right.
You know, ahead of the time. You have no idea where you'll be a week from now, / a like years from now. When we did this performance for Witness Uganda, which became Invisible Thread,
mm-hmm.
for its off-Broadway run, we were projected to go to Broadway at mm-hmm. that time. And we'd had this performance where it was at Joe's Pub, is that the Public?
Yes.
Yes. So, we had a performance at Joe's Pub, and we did this performance there, one of like our opening number, and they had introduced us as this show that's going to Broadway, Witness Uganda. And like we went up and we were like so excited, and this was 2 days before I like had to fill up my lease.
Right.
No, not even fill up my lease. It was already way past that time. It was 2 days before I didn't have a place to live.
I see.
And so it was like I'm like experiencing this thing where people are like so excited in one vein, and
right.
then at the same time it's like you don't know, like I don't know where I'm going to live.
Right.
Where I'm going to put the clothes that I've amassed and the things that I brought from Alabama and all
right.
this stuff. It's like I don't know what to do with all of this.
Right.
And now I'm like I didn't know, and I got a text from one of my former schoolmates that night saying like I could stay with them. And he like had no idea what my situation was. He was just like, you can sleep on our couch. We're moving to New York, so like we have extra space. You can stay here.
Right.
And it's just like, I'm so grateful for it now. In hindsight, it was so difficult to be grateful for it at that time. But it's just like, look at where we are now. This is, and not even saying like this is a constant thing. Like being realistic, who knows what's going to happen after this?
Right.
But at the same time, it's like, it's not so much about like being grateful just so you can be happy in the future. It's just like for what is here right now,
the present.
At the present moment.
Yeah. No, there's this business teaches you how to live in the present really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have to be taking on life one day at a time and just little by little, because you don't have any kind of reassurance that your job will be there for you, that your lease
mm-hmm.
will be there for you, and that, you know, it's tough.
Yes.
It's tough. But it's also, you know, the trade-off for living an exciting, artistic, crazy journey,
yeah.
you know? And it's one of the reasons why it's so exciting and thrilling. You said when you were talking about bartending that you being you studied all the drinks and you mm-hmm. wanted to be prepared. And I know exactly what that means, because you are very disciplined. That's what I would say. You have an athlete's discipline, because I will come up and see you blowing in a straw, leaning over a cup of hot water, breathing it in, eating pineapple every day,
mm-hmm.
every day. And so you have your specific things that you prepare to go on stage
mm-hmm.
for vocally.
Yeah.
Where do those all come from? And do you feel like having that kind of discipline is... Where does that come from in you?
The extra things like the pineapple and the straw and everything like that comes... I think that the base of that comes from the fact that I, going back to where I was like, I don't feel like... College, I didn't feel like I belonged in theater.
Right.
like, I know that I can sing.
Right.
I know that I can, but the technique of it, the technique of singing, the technique of acting and all of those things, I didn't feel like I had those when I was younger. I'm 26, but like years ago.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what that technique was. So back when I was like in college, I like looked up things of like how does like how to save your voice and like what to do and everything like that. And I would like practice in private and like in my rooms and things like that of like how to do certain things that I feel like I didn't know.
Right.
And I remember reading when I was doing summer stock at some point that pineapple is like pineapple helps your voice. That it's like an anti-inflammatory and all of these things. And right. I was like, oh, okay. So I like at that time
started I was drinking like pineapple.
I was drinking pineapple juice and everything like that. Right. And let it be because it was or because of placebo, like I was just like, it's really working. Yeah.
Right.
And so that's continued since. And I think that the straw thing came from did that come from Griffin or was that it was either from Griffin or like beforehand I'd no. This was back when I first moved to New York. I'd seen this video that was that said the same thing, and I was like, when I was going in for auditions for Witness Uganda, I felt like I was blowing my voice out so much.
Right.
And so I was looking up some stuff then, and I saw this video about using a straw and blowing into a straw and warming up with that and how it helps like focus your voice and things. And I was like, oh, okay. So I started that. The steam thing I got from just listening to other people, but it's like, I guess where that comes from is the fact that there's still that person inside of me that's like the technique, like just trying to like get the technique straight.
Yeah.
And make sure that I can, that I'm ready to prepare, that I'm prepared enough to do the next thing, to do the next scene, to be there for support for my scene partners and everything like that, because I know the emotional journey and all these things that goes into the shows that I do. Right. Slash, I know that I always want to leave room to play. And so there may be something where I want to try something different in the show. I'm going to do something that I've never done. And I want to at least be warm or warm and know the technique enough so that I can play and like right. improvise within the bounds of direction, you know, to do those things. I've been experimenting with like weaning myself off of a lot of the things that I do, the teas that I make. I eat ginger in the middle of the show, green apples and things like that. But like I just all of those things that I do, I try to wean myself off of it a little bit so that I can still be able to just do it when I need to.
One of these days you're going to have like a pineapple in your mouth while you walk on stage or something.
sometimes not intentionally, but yeah. I'll be walking on stage and it's like, I'm just about to be late and I have like a pocket of pineapple left yeah. and I'm like, just keep it in there. And then sure. like when I'm silent, just like use sure. it then. Sometimes it happens.
But I mean, I think that it's given you, I think it's so great because anytime you can have some kind of ritual or way that you approach the work
mm-hmm.
that gives you the confidence, whether it's, and also like clearly those things are helping you vocally. The physical help is amazing and the output is great. I think you're going to really double the sale of pineapples after this podcast, at least in Hell's Kitchen. But, you know, I think that it's also shows that where you came from, and this is what I was saying before, that you telling me more about how you started in theater, feeling like an outsider, feeling like, you know, I always say that people who don't go to one of those big schools who are like, you know, the conservatory training and like mm-hmm. this is it, a lot of the people who come from schools that aren't necessarily those top three or four schools where you feel like you're owed something when you get mm-hmm. out, you feel like you've been a part of this track from way before you got to college.
Yeah.
You know you had this planned out and your ambition has been since you were a young kid. And you know, I would put myself into that spoiled category in a way.
Okay.
From just that I've wanted to do this since I was 8 years old, you know, and so you think that certain things are just going to be given to you mm-hmm. when you leave college. Clearly for you, you were like, I just came into this. I feel like an outsider. I feel like that I'm not sure this is even, I belong. Mm-hmm. And so you worked harder. You didn't feel like anything was owed to you. And you continue to do that. You are working very hard backstage mm-hmm. and to make sure that you are giving the best performance. And yep. that's our job.
Yeah.
That's literally like yes. our job.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's just such a, it's a moving thing to me to see you do that and to see you go from, and I want to talk about this, go from doing it once a week mm-hmm. to going to doing it 8 times or 7 times a week.
Yeah.
What was that transition like for you?
I with this show in particular, it feels like I don't know how I will ever pay back the opportunity that's been given to me. Like this, I always feel like this is a huge, it's a huge responsibility, but it's a huge thing that's been entrusted upon me. And I love everybody who's had a part of the decision who brought me into the show. And so when doing the show once a week, a couple times a week, being Javi's alternate, what I had with that is that there was so much, it was frustrating at times because I'd been so used to doing shows seven times a week, eight times a week, doing shows like as a lead, as a part of the ensemble, something like that. That was just in my body. So when I got that first taste in New York of doing it, and then I'd take a seat.
Yeah.
It was so weird, and I had so much energy to do that. And just doing it a few times a week was weird to me at first. And then I understood what that was as that position, you know, because if like you have like a main role and then you have an alternate and both of you are burned out, how are you going to do the show? You know, and so it was a really interesting learning process of like how to focus that energy and figure out like what I can do. And like now I do have to figure out like a process so that I can maintain that support system.
Yeah.
To be there, you know. And so it was like that. Once conversations and finality of the figures to make this happen, to make the tour happen, to be doing it 7 times a week, it's been more discipline. And what it is like it's now to a point where, I mean, we've been here for about 2 months, like it's experimenting every week of like what can I do in my professional work to make the show happen every week, slash what can I do in my personal life to make sure that I'm still healthy, heart, mind, soul, body, everything, so that I can do that and still be a person.
Yeah.
And, what was I going to say? I forgot what I was going to say. That's fine. I think that doing this 8 times a week or 7 times a week now is, I think that's what I was going to say. It was just, you know that there's going to be fatigue. You know that you're going to be tired and all these things. And I've gotten to a point where it's like, you know, those things, you don't have to waste a lot of energy on worrying about it, because it's only going to deplete you even more. You accept it and you do the show that you can do, try to create what you can do, that create a show that you can do 7 times a week, back to back to back to back, something on 2 show days, everything like that, so that you know what it is.
Right.
And know that the hits are going to come when they come. You're going to get a strange pain in this area that you weren't expecting to because you did some move or whatever. That's probably going to happen. I felt that today.
Yeah.
Of just like a random thing. And then it's like, okay, stretch, and then you're good.
Yeah.
But it's like random things will happen to your body because you're pushing it even more than an alternate position where you're only doing it once a week or a couple times a week.
Sure.
You're pushing yourself. And so it's like knowing that you're pushing yourself a little bit more than ever before, and accepting that and knowing that at the same time, like sometimes I feel like I can't do it.
Yeah.
And how and the world's going to know your name. What's your name, man? Alexander Hamilton. Oh, no. like I don't know what's going to happen for this show because I feel like sometimes I'll get to the end of my shot and I'm like, I'm dead. But there's still like 50 something more songs that go.
50, yeah.
How do I do this?
Yeah.
And so it's like relying on the show that you've built and relying on the discipline of just like I try to create like not a 7-show week, but like just a little over, like something that I can do, like if it's an impossible situation, it's never going to happen, but like a 10-show week or something like that. Prepare enough so that it's like you know that you have enough space or enough energy to do everything else.
Right.
So it's like I know that I'm tired. I'm relying on the fact that I have this extra energy that I planned. Instead of 2-show days, it's like a 3-show day. Hmm. Okay, great. Now I have 3-show energy. And I'm going to feel very tired by 2, but as long as there's enough to do a 3rd show, then I think that I'm good.
Now, I'm worried that you're going home and doing a 3rd show, Michael.
No. Goodness, no. I get home, I eat, TV's on sometimes, yeah. I'll read, but I'll stretch out, warm down, cool down, and everything like that, but like, I'm done.
Or you write in your journal in the smallest little writing I've ever seen in my life. Michael has a journal, and how many lines do you write within
3 to 6.
3 to 6.
Lines within lines. The 2 lines.
Within the 2 lines.
Yeah.
That's how small he can write. I've never seen anything like it.
It's comforting.
But that's not something, you're journaling, so it's not always like you going back and writing or reading through it. It's kind of just...
It's a lot of it's stream of conscious. Sometimes it will evolve to like ideas and things that I've had or letters that I'm writing to people that I'll never send or conversations that I'm having with ideas or anything like that. But it's just,
it's kind of like a meditation.
Like,
for
it's
you.
Just writing. Yeah. Wow. Like, yeah.
It's beautiful. I really, really think you should like wallpaper something with it one day. It's gorgeous. Yeah. It's like, it looks, I don't know. It's like a beautiful design.
Yeah.
But before we go, I wanted to talk about my favorite part of the show. We have to end, Michael. You have a lot of pineapple to eat before tonight's performance.
I just love talking to you, so this is great.
Hey, we got a whole bunch of time to talk.
Yeah.
But my favorite part of the show, which I told you recently, I was going to wait until we talked on this podcast, but I couldn't. Is they changed the end of my show. When I come out for Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story, I enter from the surround at center stage where you are just exiting. And so we have this moment at the end of the show where you're coming off stage and I get to give you a hug.
Yeah.
And it is such an awesome moment for me because I'm not just I'm so proud of you, if I can say that. I'm so proud of getting to and honored to have gotten to be there for your first day, seeing you come into the Richard Rogers and seeing a man who was like wide-eyed, like, oh my god, and who just handled it so well. And who has come to this place in San Francisco and just been a leader and who gives all of himself as an actor in a way that it challenges me to be a better performer. When you walk off that stage and you have those tears in your eyes and when we get to hug, I know it's like, it's a lot. Yeah. It's about letting go of some of the energy that you just had to put out there on that stage, and I'm honored to get to have that. I think it was the universe.
I love that happens every single night.
Yeah,
I really do.
I'll also share that. You know, I've thought you were amazing from your first show, but sometimes you realize something when somebody else from a different perspective says it, and I'll never forget. Your first show that Renee Elise Goldsberry was in, because I think she was away.
She was that, like, the first week that I was in. Yeah.
So you had done the show, and she came into the show, and it was during Quiet Uptown, I always saw her at the end of that, which is always a very emotional song for her. Mm-hmm. And she was grabbing an extra amount of Kleenex after her first time seeing that with you performing in Quiet Uptown. And she just said to me, "He's just so good. He's so good." And I wanted to tell you that because how many hundreds of times has she did that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that it's hard for people like us who come into a show mm-hmm. to be, like you had said, I had never done that, come into a show that was up there, to respect the baby that was birthed by these human beings and who loved it so much. And I just thought, yeah, he is good. And if Renee can see that, he must be damn good. And you know, there's a reason why you're here being our leader, our Hamilton in San Francisco. And so I just wanted to share that.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Whew. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I know.
It's the thing that I love about this. I mean, like I said before, just the community of it.
Yeah.
To be able to be working with such amazing artists at this point in my life, learning from them, and being able to create and express with them. It's with all of us who are here, you know.
Right.
It's the most amazing thing.
It is. Yeah. And I've learned a lot from you, young man. I really have. And I look up to you for your discipline and your heart, and you don't leave anything off the table or out. You give all of yourself on that stage, and it's truly, truly remarkable.
Thank you.
And thank you for giving all of yourself to Living the Dream podcast.
Heck yes.
All right, and so you have to tell other cast members that it's fun to do. That's what I always say.
You do always say that in the podcast. I listen to it.
So I'm like, because yeah. I don't want to be afraid when I ask them to do it.
I don't know why anybody would be. I mean, just talking. I love this.
It's fun, right? Yeah. To have a longer, because you know, I started it because we had so much Twitter and you know, social media, but it's like sitting down and having a long conversation with another human being, another artist, about the reality of what it really takes, and you know, how wonderful it is and how difficult it is. Yeah. And so I appreciate your honesty.
Yes.
And for doing it. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Let's get to blowing in those straws and eating that pineapple.
Show number two. Yeah.
Here we go.
Audition, side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.